This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello and welcome to Trumpet Hour Week in Review. I'm Philip Nice, and today is April 19th, 2024, a significant date, a date which lives in a certain infamy for those of us who remember Waco, Texas, and a certain morning in Oklahoma City, a date that does remind us of how sobering things can get and how quickly they can get that way. I'm here with our Philadelphia Trumpet writers, Mihailo Zekic.
Hello.
Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
Jeremiah Jacques.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And we're going to go in that order, and there are some sobering events this week happening, first of all, in the Middle East. Mihailo?
The Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps captured the MSC Ares, a merchant ship in the Strait of Hormuz in the Middle East. The IRGC is Iran's one of the two branches of the Iranian armed forces. In particular, they're meant to protect the Islamic Revolution and export it. And apparently exporting the Islamic Revolution means capturing civilian ships. In this case, although it's flagged as Portuguese, it's connected to an Israeli shipping magnate. And this was made as a jab to Israel. We've obviously talked a lot about the Red Sea and what Iran's Houthi proxies are doing there. That's not the only maritime trade route Iran has significant leverage over. It directly borders the Strait of Hormuz, and a lot of oil-producing countries rely on that waterway to export their oil. We don't know if Iran's going to keep doing this kind of thing. We'll certainly keep our eyes on that. Iran also did something even more major on Saturday, which we'll talk about for the main segment. And on Tuesday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu hosted in his office an emergency talks on the International Criminal Court. This is not the International Court of Justice that South Africa took Israel to on charges of genocide. That's an organ of the UN that charges countries. The International Criminal Court, or ICC, charges individuals. And apparently there are rumors that they're going to charge Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, and some other figures in the Israeli government, in the Israeli military, with arrest warrants, which Israel is not a party to the treaty that makes the ICC binding. A lot of other countries are. A few years ago, they charged Putin and one of his cronies for charges of genocide. And because of that, Putin, since the war in Ukraine has started, hasn't really been going around the world too much, because technically a bunch of countries that he would visit are legally obligated to arrest him if he lands on their soil. If Putin is taking it seriously, that tells you something. And arguably, there's way more people in the world that hate Benjamin Netanyahu even more than Vladimir Putin. So if this is going to cause a lot of diplomatic problems, physically stopping Mr. Netanyahu from traveling to countries, or if they'll even do anything, the court that is, in the first place, remains to be seen. But if the Israeli prime minister is taking it seriously, then it means that something's cooking.
And it seems like every week we've got some sort of international body, some international court or the United Nations or some subset of the United Nations targeting Israel in general. And in this case, Benjamin Netanyahu specifically. Iran, of course, seizing that vessel, the MSC Ares, on April 13th. It's becoming more and more belligerent. It's pushing more and more. You mentioned it's the topic of your main segment.
Yes. So as I'm sure most of our listeners are aware, on Saturday, Iran sent over 300 drones and missiles to Israel. This was in response to the assassination of that IRGC general in Damascus that happened earlier. This was their Iran kept saying that they're going to respond, and they finally responded. And that in and of itself would be a big enough story to cover on the Week in Review. But basically throughout the whole week, there has been update after update involving multiple actors that keep making this event increasingly complex. Israel, of course, has its Iron Dome missile defense system to protect against threats like this, and it did use it. There have, thankfully, aside from one Bedouin girl that was severely injured from shrapnel, hasn't been any injuries or casualties. But Iron Dome in and of itself didn't actually shoot down most of these. It was the United States, the United Kingdom, and interestingly enough, Jordan and Saudi Arabia contributed to protecting Israel. And there were a few other missiles that came from places like Iraq and Yemen as well. So it was an attack on all sides, and a lot of Israel's allies, and in this case, unlikely partners, stepped in to take care of this for the Arab countries' parts. Jordan was just saying our airspace was violated, so of course we jumped in. Saudi Arabia is staying particularly silent about this. But it goes without saying it's interesting to see some of these Arab countries stepping in to protect Israel. For the United States and the United Kingdom's part, Israel has said they were going to retaliate. The U.S. and the U.K. were saying, don't do it, don't do it. Joe Biden reportedly said, you got to win, take the win. I don't really know how it's a win when somebody got hurt on Israeli territory and a lot more people would have gotten hurt if their missile defense system didn't turn out as well as possible. Israel, for its part, they've been using the Biden administration's reluctance to let Israel retaliate to do a bit of wrangling. According to an anonymous Egyptian official which spoke to media, Israel promised not to have a heavy retaliation if the U.S. stopped its stonewalling of support for the Rafah offensive, which has been supposed to be happening for a while now and hasn't been happening. So who knows, maybe this is a harbinger that this will take place. And then earlier today, Israel finally did retaliate in a very precise, some would say underwhelming way. They did an airstrike on a military air base at the city of Isfahan in Iran. Israel, for themselves, are not admitting it. Iran said that something happened, but they're staying low-key. The U.S. or U.S. officials are telling media that they can confirm it happened. The big reason why Isfahan is such an interesting target is because it is a very important city in regards to Iran's nuclear program. It has four nuclear research facilities, and it is close geographically to the Natanz uranium enrichment site. Some listeners might recognize that name. It pops up every now and then when nuclear negotiations happen. As far as we know, no actual nuclear sites have been targeted. But if Israel was going to give a response to that barrage of drones and missiles within the constraints the U.S. gave them, I'd say this is probably about as big of a sending a message as they could. They didn't target or hit any sensitive sites, but they hit something right next door. And the message is basically, if push comes to shove, we're going to hit these sites next. What is Iran going to do about this?
In case the Israeli regime embarks on adventurism again and takes action against the interests of Iran, the next response from us will be immediate and at a maximum level. It will be decisive. Our response will be decisive through the Swiss Embassy in Tehran. We have announced to the White House, sent a message to the White House and Washington, D.C., the administration, in which we reiterated that if the Israeli regime commits that grave error once again, our response will be decisive, definitive, and regretful for them.
That was Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian speaking to CNN via translator. That interview was just published right before the attacks that Israel made happened. And as you could hear there, he's saying that if Israel retaliates against us, we're going to retaliate again up a notch. Whether Iran, this is just a bluff, whether Iran is going to do some face-saving measure, or whether they're extremely serious about this and going to attack Israel even further, at this point remains to be seen. By the time this episode airs, they could very well have done something. But as we can see, things are pretty volatile in the Middle East, and they're probably only going to get even more volatile.
We're recording this kind of in the midst of a shots fired situation, but directly between Israel and Iran, actual warfare between the two, obviously not a declaration of war and large troop movements, but actual direct drone and missile strikes and airstrikes between the two. And that's what everyone fears. And what do you think about this idea of take the win? Like, basically, you've both shot off at each other. Now just both of you back off. Is that the approach to take? I mean, do we want to see an escalation or do we not?
To be fair, I don't think it's smart for Israel to just do random tit for tats. If they are going to attack, it should be something strategic like the nuclear program, which in my opinion, they should be bombing regardless. They've been reluctant to do so for obvious reasons, but for restraining escalation. Since the war in Gaza started, the message from the United States is we support Israel in every single way. And then something pops up where they're actually going to do something about their problems with their jihadi neighbors in the United States. Well, not that. And then they try to do something else. Well, not that either. This is just another point to add to that list. We've talked a lot on this program before about how the United States, at least under Joe Biden, under Barack Obama, wants to empower Iran. This can be looked at as a continuation of that. Our assistant managing editor who's sitting right next to me in the Edston office, Mr. Palmer, he wrote an article about how
I was about to jump in and say this. It's not just a continuation. It's a direct result. Like, just after October 7th, the sanctions came up for renewal on Iran's missile and drone program, the same missiles and drones that they just used to attack Israel. And the United States could have triggered or put pressure on its allies to trigger the snapback. We hear about snapback all the time. Back when Barack Obama was doing his nuclear deal, the JCPOA, we were told if Iran steps a toe out of line, it's all going to snap back. And there's nothing Russia and China can do to shield Iran from the consequences of snapback if America triggers it. All they had to do was have a letter sent that said the UN is, or that Iran is in breach of its obligations under the nuclear deal, which is indisputably true. They didn't do it. They signed a joint statement saying that, but they didn't send a letter to the Security Council. They did not trigger that. So, I mean, America enabled this. And I think that's been the story of this whole week, is kind of they enabled this attack to happen. Then we find out, at least according to an anonymous diplomat, that they knew what the attack was going to be. And they told Iran, basically, go ahead as long as it's not too big, which... I don't know if America, you know more U.S. history than I do, if America's ever given the go-ahead on an attack on an ally, like saying, yeah, no, that's fine.
It's such a nasty world of international politics. Let's take the win idea. On the surface, it's like, oh, we moved our carrier, you know, we shot down some drones, let's all calm down again. On this gradual push to make Israel indefensible. Like, it's this ongoing strategic push where when something pops up and dominates the headline, as they can say, we're still supporting Israel, when in fact they're pushing them into an absolute indefensible corner. And as you said, this is directly after October 7th. Like, there wasn't even a cooling down period. Even in that time, the United States facilitating Iran's continued rise, continued dominance. And Mihailo Zekic, you're pointing to this for a specific reason, and it's not just because it's in the news this week.
Yes, so actually the fact that this kind of stuff keeps popping up in the news this week, that Iran and Israel are at it again, whether through their proxies, whether through direct at this point, the fact that it's not surprising, and the fact that when you listen to a lot of other media, that they talk about these things as if, you know, it's expected or that kind of thing, that in and of itself is a big story. This drone attack that Iran did, that's the first time Iran has directly attacked Israeli soil from its own soil. Some people are saying this is the first time Israel has attacked Iran from its own soil. I don't, if you count all the operations Mossad has done, I don't think that's accurate. But Iran has been the power behind this whole war in Israel from multiple fronts, whether it's Hamas, whether it's Lebanon, whether it's the Houthis, they're all proxies of Iran. You go back a few years, not even that long ago, all these problems in the Middle East, whether it's Yasser Arafat and his terror groups, whether it's Saddam Hussein, whether it's ISIS, whether it's Al-Qaeda, most of these groups were not sponsored by Iran. A lot of these groups, maybe they cooperated with Iran or did some business every now and then, but they were mostly in it for themselves. And when they got involved with some of these other groups, sometimes they'd start fighting them. In this case, the whole crisis in the Middle East, from Yemen to Gaza to Lebanon to now Iran itself, it all has its nerve center in Tehran. It's all orchestrated by one power. It's, in a sense, one huge terrorist empire. And as far as the Middle East goes, that hasn't happened, at least for decades, where you have one power controlling all the chaos, where you have one power pulling all the strings everywhere. And this attack, and the responses to this attack, show the gloves are off. It's not just these isolated groups that may cooperate with each other doing things. It's all this one giant tentacled monster that's causing chaos throughout the whole region. And the reason I think that is important is because in a prophecy we go to often again, Daniel 11, verse 40, which speaks of an end-time king of the south pushing, provoking a king of the north, which we've written a lot of literature talking about how that's modern Europe. This king of the south, the rest of the prophecy goes, is going to take over more countries and as part of his proxy empire in the Middle East and Africa. Eventually, the prophecy states it's going to start World War III. Our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has pointed to Iran being the head of the snake of this king of the south, being the main leader and controlling a proxy empire. That wasn't the case even just a few years ago, at least what the mainstream media could see. It wasn't the case that Iran was king over radical Islamist terror. All these episodes this whole week basically show, yes, Iran is undisputedly the king. It's not even hiding anymore. You could even call it an emperor because it's an empire. For radical Islam to control this much leverage, so centralized with so much authority of one power, is unprecedented. And it just vindicates the prophecies that Mr. Fleury has been pointing to for year after year after year when nobody else was.
And I think that's one of the big fascinating things about this story is it brings so many details of the prophecies that you were just talking about to life. Like every aspect of this is almost a different aspect of Daniel 11. I mean, obviously you hit upon by far the biggest one with Iran as this king of the south. But then you look at the way that Saudi Arabia and Jordan and these Arab countries, these Sunni Arab countries, intercepted missiles, shot the missiles down. In our King of the South booklet, we have this whole other chapter on, I think the chapter is called A Mysterious Alliance, where you put Daniel 11 alongside some other scriptures like Psalm 83, and it talks about basically this hidden conspiracy, this group of nations that take crafty counsels, to use the King James English, that pretend to be on Israel's side, this group of Arab nations that pretend to be on Israel's side but are not. And you see that forming with what's going on over there. Another point Mr. Fleury makes in the King of the South booklet is you go to Daniel 11 and America's not there. And that's also kind of what we see this week with America betraying Israel. Basically, you know, whatever role that they play is kind of on the other side of the equation to Israel, against trying to slow Israel down and prevent attacks and push off retaliation and really enabling the rise of Iran. You know, that ties into a whole host of other prophecies. So really what you're seeing in the Middle East, I mean, it's not just there's a vague prophecy, and if you kind of squint at world events, it vaguely matches. Like, it is a really precise match in so many different ways. The Bible is telling you exactly what you're seeing and all the different facets of it on the news. And it really does underscore the power of that book as something that describes your world and your life with then the problems and the solutions right now.
And before we move on, I would like to mention our latest print edition. Mr. Fleury wrote an article where he talked about all these things that Iran is doing might be the push of Daniel 11, verse 40. We often talk about Iran's pushiness on this program, but I've been a bit hesitant to say it's the push. And I'm not in Mr. Fleury's position, but with what Mr. Palmer said, all these prophecies intersecting, you could see how this could morph into the push.
That's right. That's the May-June 2024 Philadelphia Trumpet. You can have a look at that at thetrumpet.com, as well as the King of the South. Updated in 2023, that updated chapter title is Another More Mysterious Alliance. And then just think about this fact. This book was first published in 1996. You go back to 1979 when the Iranian regime came into power. There have been so many reasons and so many opportunities for that regime to fall, to be pressured out of existence. And look at how it continues to exist, and look at how, as you say, Mihailo, it's at this point an empire of terror in the Middle East, and it's directly this week attacking Israel. You heard Richard Palmer there. He's been watching the Middle East, as have we all this week, but he also watches Europe. Mr. Palmer, what's the update on Europe?
Moderate conservatives tried to attend a national conservatism conference in Brussels on Tuesday, when one of Brussels' mayors shut it down and sent police to completely close it. The fact that you could have a political conference attended by prime ministers and members of the European Parliament shut down for it by police gained a whole lot of headlines. I think it shone a bright spotlight on censorship going on within the European Union, something I wrote about in our latest Trumpet print, The Global War on Free Speech. It was able to go ahead the next day, but it really shows that anything that's even just a little outside of this very narrow liberal worldview can very quickly be banned. And a piece of religious news, Pope Francis has resumed the title Patriarch of the West. It's a title the previous pope retired in 2006, but the newest edition of the Vatican yearbook includes this. The pope hasn't explained why, but of course, if you're hearing the word patriarch, that immediately makes you think Eastern Orthodox, and perhaps Patriarch of the West is designed to be a more Eastern Orthodox-friendly title. This could point to some more reconciliation. These two branches have already made a lot, moved quite close to unity, and it could be more in this direction. That's something that is specifically prophesied as we talk about in our Returning to the Fold chapter in our book, He Was Right.
That takes some level of courage to organize a conservatism conference in Brussels. And that's, it's very intriguing what the Patriarch of the West title and just what the Pope has been up to in the Vatican. I'm sure we'll hear more about that. And that's a very strong take. Again, that chapter was Returning to the Fold in He Was Right on thetrumpet.com. What's your main story out of Europe this week?
On Saturday, the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz began his longest and most emphasized foreign trip of his time in office to date. So the venue of this trip shows you a lot about Germany's priorities, who they think is the most important country to improve relations with right now. And that trip was to China. He was there for about 3 days. It was quite a big trip. There were other members of government with him. There were quite a few different members of industry traveling with him. So Mercedes, BMW, they were going there. BSAF, this big chemical giant, so many of these other businesses. And a big focus for him on this trip was trade. He wanted to come up with a more reasonable trade relationship with China that will allow China to sell to Europe, but also allow Europe to sell more to China, to restrict some of the more uncompetitive things that China does. And what was interesting was what he was willing to compromise for this. So there were two words that did not pass his lips the entire trip. They were human rights. So he was very careful to avoid discussion of certain areas, to not talk about things like China locking a couple of million Uyghurs in concentration camps and any of this. Politico, their article on the subject, they titled it Why Germany Scholz is Bowing to the Chinese Dragon. And they said that Scholz was groveling. They talked about how he made his TikTok debut. You know, this is something very much in the news. ByteDance, this Chinese company, this Chinese social media app. Are they going to be allowed to do business in all these different countries? And the German chancellor opens a TikTok account right before making this trip. And so he is very much courting China. And one point I can't resist making in passing is I think the whole relationship with China is a massive indictment of the woke movement that talks so much about past guilt of slavery. And you have literal slavery going on right now. And it's all the most woke companies that are up to their eyeballs with it. And so you have companies like Nike, I think they say in the States, Nike, we tend to call it over here, that make such a big deal about racism and slavery and legacy, and then never stop lecturing the American public and have slaves make their shoes in China. Like, you have so many industries doing this. And some of these are German. You have companies like Siemens that has a big section on their website all devoted to never again. We're changed. We're an ethical company. Yes, we benefited. We used slave labor from concentration camps in World War II, and we've learned. And they're using slave labor in concentration camps in China. I mean, it just, objectively, this is a massive evil that is going on right now. And we talk about so many past evils, so many imagined evils. But because of China's economic clout, we will not talk about this present evil so much of the time. And there are a lot of other evils going on as well. But that, I think, we have to point out. But another critical takeaway here is that this was prophesied. This is something that was forecasted. And this has been something I have found really fascinating to watch, where Isaiah chapter 23 is the key prophecy here. And it talks about, it calls it a mart of nations, the market of nations taking place between Tyre, this modern European power in Bible prophecy, and Kittim, which is a biblical name for China. And Mr. Flores first started talking about this in around 2010, 2011. And prior to that, nobody was really talking about Germany and China. Within 2 or 3 years, China was starting to become Angela Merkel's most visited non-European destination. And I believe by the time she finished office, that's where it was. And people were writing about a special relationship between Germany and China. That's what she created. And now you see Scholz, again, his longest foreign trip. And where is he going? China. It's building right before your eyes. It's the fulfillment of this prophecy. Now, I think there are still some ups and downs in that relationship before it's completely fulfilled. At the moment, I would say China is kind of in the dominant position and maybe taking advantage of Europe and Europe's weakness and dividedness at the moment. You read Isaiah chapter 23, and that's not the case. If anything, this European power is the more dominant, or maybe it's a more equal partnership. So I think I could see there being some rockiness as we move towards that kind of destination. And I think we have seen some of that rockiness in 2 or 3 years where European leaders have been standing up and saying, well, China is taking advantage of us. That's to be expected. That does not discount the prophecy. So this has been just a remarkable journey where we've been able to watch this prophecy being fulfilled before your eyes very quickly.
I'm reminded, too, of Emmanuel Macron going to China. I think that was last year, and all the pomp and circumstance afforded to him and that clear avoidance of touchy terms such as human rights in China, just the rights of human beings by the millions, and bowing, as they say, to the Chinese Communist Party. And the link that Mr. Palmer provided that you'll be interested to look at is why the Trumpet watches the development of a massive anti-American trade bloc. That's at thetrumpet.com/trends, why the Trumpet watches the development of a massive anti-American trade bloc. And it's interesting because if you know about the Trumpet's forecasts, you know that there's an eventual forecast of a very destructive relationship between Europe and Asia. And yet there is also the level of detail is interesting. There's also, prior to that, a forecast of a unification in terms of trade between Asia and Europe. That's what Mr. Palmer is referring to there. And we're seeing that develop as Europe becomes more and more of an economic and a military superpower, China racing toward that. And you'll want to have a look at why the Trumpet watches the development of a massive anti-American trade bloc there on thetrumpet.com. You're listening to KPCG Trumpet Hour Week in Review. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Hello and welcome back to Trumpet Hour Week in Review on April 19th, 2024. We've covered the Middle East and the eruption of direct strikes between Israel and Iran there. And we've covered Europe and the significant trip German Chancellor Olaf Scholz made to the world's greatest rising power, China. Now we'll focus on China and the Asia region with an update from Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, first of all, an update on Russia's war against Ukraine. The lines have changed very little, really for over a year now, but the death tolls keep on rising, and Russia is increasingly driving it up with a tactic called double tapping. This is when they strike a civilian target with a missile, maybe an apartment complex or a school or shopping center, any place that's sure to have people inside, and then they wait about 30 minutes or an hour, just long enough to know that paramedics and firemen and police are swarming that area trying to help the injured. And then the Russians strike that exact same spot with another missile or volley of missiles. So it's a double tap. And with this tactic, the Russians have been able to kill large numbers of civilian first responders. It is particularly heinous. This is the kind of thing that you would expect from Islamic terrorists, but this is coming from Vladimir Putin's Russia. And the cost in human capital for Ukraine is immense. But Ukraine also had some gains this week. Their armed forces struck a Russian military base in occupied Crimea on Wednesday. And this was a major strike. Ukraine managed to take out four of Russia's S-400 launchers, also three radar stations, and a command post for air defense operations. So it was a really a devastating strike on this Russian military base that will leave the rest of the base quite vulnerable in the near term. The next story here is about China, but it's also about Russia's war. So this is new evidence showing that China is selling Russia vast amounts of all kinds of militarily useful items. And this is playing a major role in keeping Russia's war machine humming and killing. This new report shows that 90% of Russia's microelectronics now come from China. Also, 70% of Russia's machine tool imports now come from China. The Chinese are also helping Russia build up their satellite systems in ways that have direct applications to the war on Ukraine. So the Chinese are trying not to directly violate sanctions that ban direct military assistance to Russia, but they are finding all kinds of loopholes in those sanctions, and what they're sending to Russia is making a major difference on the battlefields.
As you were talking, as Mihailo was talking as well, I was just thinking we are crossing lines, like major lines are being crossed in these different conflicts, in actual violence and warfare. It's just disgusting to think of someone with almost a superpower, nation state military assets, using those to target civilians, then using them again to target first responders. I mean, how demoralizing as well to a people. And yet the Ukrainians continue to fight. That's an amazing and bloody and horrible spectacle that's happening over there. And we are crossing lines and the world still seems to be holding together, but we're blowing through diplomatic safeguards and so forth that there's no coming back from, it feels like to me. Your main story is also the crossing of a line, I would say.
I would say so too. Yeah, this is a story about Russian military hackers carrying out a cyber attack on a Texas water facility that caused a major reservoir to overflow. So this is according to a new report that was published Wednesday by Mandiant, the cybersecurity firm. And this water facility is in Muleshoe, Texas. And the attack sent thousands of gallons of water, tens of thousands of gallons actually, flowing into the streets. And at the same time, two other towns in northeastern Texas also recorded harmful cyber activity being carried out on their networks. And it all traces back to a hacker group called Sandworm, which is a unit of Russia's GRU military intelligence agency. These attacks happened apparently back in January, and they were serious. But in some ways, it also looks like Sandworm is almost just practicing with these kind of low-key cyber attacks, just establishing entry points, you know, exploiting vulnerabilities and developing effective tactics and kind of preparing for a time when they will unleash their full fury. So it's very sobering to think about the, you know, the full capacities that Russia may be developing. But really, even just with these attacks as they happened, it's already a very serious development.
If confirmed, this would mark an escalation of Russia targeting U.S. critical infrastructure. As of today, Muleshoe City Manager Ramon Sanchez says the city has replaced the system that was hacked.
That was Angie Nguyen there with KCBD News in Texas, very close to the place where the worst of these attacks took place. And as she noted there, if this happened the way it looks to have happened, with Russian military backing, that would mark a serious escalation in Russia targeting critical American infrastructure. As you just said a moment ago there, Mr. Nice, that's a real line that was crossed. And it's also notable that the Sandworm attacks come just on the heels of revelations about Chinese hackers infecting hundreds of U.S. routers with KV botnet malware. So China is believed to have infected U.S. electrical grids, oil and natural gas pipelines, water facilities, and transportation systems. So it's a wide range of networks that have apparently been compromised, and many of these support military bases. And apparently they're now just waiting for the time when the Chinese hackers decide to flip the switch on what they've already implanted. So you know, both Russia and China are devoting major resources to hacking the U.S., and it looks like they're growing far more capable and sophisticated in these attacks. And it's very sobering to consider just how vulnerable America seems to be to all this.
The first thing that pops into my mind hearing this is it's a big debate in the United States between people that want the U.S. to remain internationalist and be involved in certain areas and other people that say that, you know, all these countries can keep doing whatever they want. Let's not get involved. That doesn't impact us. That's several oceans away. In this globalized world, especially with a system like the internet where everything's connected online, anything that happens anywhere, anything that involves anybody anywhere, even if you live in a small town and you think that something's not going to impact you, it can very well impact you. Whether it's right for one country to be doing something in another part of the world or not, or for your country to be doing, to be involved in other countries is another matter. But whether you like it or not, what happens, the decisions made in Beijing, the decisions made in Moscow, they are going to impact you. You might not think you're a target. Everybody is a target in this globalized system. At the very least, it shows how important it is to stay abreast with some of these developments and to think that, oh, that's just like so far away. It's not going to impact us. It can impact anybody in a lot of ways we'd probably be surprised in.
So you're sitting in Mule Shoe, Texas, watching the 9 o'clock news on KCBD, and your boy plays football for the Mules, and you feel like you're a world away from Chinese hackers and water is flowing down your streets. That shows how globalized our world has become, how this is going to affect all of us. And that's a signal being sent right now. I think it's a setup for future attacks, as you say. It's also a signal right now. China can apply pressure when the United States government surely knows that things like this are happening. That's a threat. You know, I have learned that we are always at war. And thankfully, it's not yet a hot war. But these types of things are going on all the time. And China has now crossed the line to attack infrastructure more or less openly, I would say, right in rural America, Mule Shoe, Texas, just down the interstate from where we are right now.
That's exactly right. And these kinds of reports about hacks on America that are happening now, they are very sobering. But for those who follow the trumpet, they really shouldn't be surprising. Because Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Terrell Fleury has been warning for years about the dangers of America's dependence on computer systems, particularly in the military realm. Starting all the way back in the mid-90s, he began sounding the alarm about this, and he said that this threat reminded him of a passage in Ezekiel 7 that talks about a future time when God will punish America for its refusal to turn to him. And verse 14 of that chapter describes one aspect of that punishment. It says, "They have blown the trumpet even to make all ready, but none goes to the battle." Mr. Fleury said this is about a time when the U.S. military's technology will have been kind of hijacked by enemies, and it prevents America from mobilizing or responding. And you can see how that could be the case if certain electrical systems and communication systems were compromised. So it's very chilling to consider the full potential of these kinds of attacks. It goes way beyond just overflowing a reservoir in a small Texas town. And for anyone who would like to understand all of this in the context of Bible prophecy, we have an article called China Hacks America and None Goes to Battle.
That's China Hacks America and, quote, none goes to battle, a reference to the Bible, as you said there. Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury warning about an electronic technology vulnerability for decades now, what we often call it an attack vector in the modern lingo. But he did that not because he had some sort of experience in information technology or anything like that, but because he recognized early on a parallel connection between the American reliance on electronic information technology and this phrase, they have blown the trumpet, but none goes to the battle. And so if you've been looking for that, you're seeing it now very clearly. If a foreign adversary wanted to use America's reliance on electronic computer technology to close bridges, destroy bridges, overflow reservoirs, overload reactors, shut down electrical grids, we can now more easily, even the less imaginative of us can imagine it and picture it in stark terms. So we move now to the Anglo-America region. Andrew Miller, you've been watching Anglo-America this week and every week. What do you have for us this week?
Yeah, this week the Anti-Defamation League gave Harvard University and 11 other United States universities failing grades for their policies to protect Jewish students after Hamas's October 7th attack on Israel. Shockingly, the mayor of Denver, Colorado, announced plans to cut the city's police budget by $8.4 billion in a stated move to better accommodate illegal immigrants, to whom apparently the police were giving a hard time. And the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in an appeal by Joseph Fisher, who was a January 6 protester, jailed on charges of obstructing an official proceeding. We'll be watching this court case closely in the days and weeks ahead, but since the Justice Department is applying a new interpretation to a law made to stop another Enron scandal from destroying financial records, it seems the court is probably going to side with Joseph Fisher and against the Department of Justice in this case.
So we're seeing real world missiles, suicide drones, infrastructure attacks, and overloads. And what you mentioned, Jeremiah, that just the inhuman carnage in Ukraine, missile strikes on ambulance medics. This is the world we're living in. This is what we're tolerating as a human race. And we're thinking, maybe some of us, of just how bad it can get on an April 19th, whether it's 2024 or whether it's in the 1990s. Things can get bad. Things can strike home to you. And there's a connection that I urge you, dear listener, to understand that connects not just to who has enough shells and who has the guns and who has the computers, but to these decisions that are made in international bodies by governments, by individuals in government. These decisions are many times what lead to the killing and lead to the carnage. And we've got both of them going on, both dangerous decisions going on and the results, the real world results of those decisions going on constantly every week at this point, and we are struggling to keep you up to date. But I think your main story, Andrew, is more about the decision-making and the leadership here in Anglo-America.
Yeah, the main story is actually is with all this violence and chaos and conflict you've been hearing about, I think we can agree that the Pax Americana is coming to an end. For the past at least seven decades, the world's been in a pretty peaceful period compared to its other periods due to a fact of defense by the U.S. military. But it is a time-honored lesson of history that nations and empires usually fall apart when the cost of servicing their debts exceeds their defense budget. America has passed that point. Here in year 2024, we are expected to spend $870 billion on interest payments on the national debt, and probably only between $820 and $860 billion on defense, depending on how you count. So less on defense than on interest payments. And those interest payments are getting bigger every year, which means the budget's being squeezed and Congress has some big decisions to make about the priorities with its spending. Now, for the past 2 months, Congress has been trying to pass a big whopper $118 billion security bill that would provide funding for the U.S. southern border, funding for Ukraine, funding for Israel, funding for Taiwan. And they haven't been able to get it passed just due to infighting in Congress. A lot of the Republicans who want to vote for the bill because of the border funding don't want to send money to Ukraine. Some of the Democrats who want to send money to Ukraine don't want to send money to the border. So Mike Johnson actually did a pretty savvy move that Congress should do more often and split the whopper bill into four bills. He's like, we now have one bill that's supposed to allot $20 billion to defending the U.S.-Mexico border, another bill that would give $61 billion to Ukraine to fight the Russians, another bill that would give about $26 billion to Israel to fend off Hamas and Hezbollah, and another bill that would give a little over $8 billion to Taiwan to shore up its defenses to make a Chinese invasion unlikely. So now that it's in four bills, the Congress people can debate over what we think our priorities should be. Now, it looks like because the I think the Democrats are definitely for the Ukraine bill, and there's a number of Republicans for the Ukraine bill, that that one will probably pass. We'll see what happens with the Israel bill, the Taiwan bill, and the one, even though it probably should be our highest priority, that's least likely to pass is defending our own people from drug cartels and the chaos on the southern border. I think just looking at it, it's like none of these projects are bad projects. I mean, it'd be great if we could defend our southern border. It would be great if we can defend Taiwan. It would be great if we could defend Israel. And it could be great if we can defend Ukraine. But it's getting to a lot of the debates in here is like, says, do we actually have the money to keep doing this when we're spending $870 billion on interest each year? I know it's something Donald Trump's thinking about. He actually met this week with the president of Poland. The president of Poland came to the United States, met with Donald Trump, and the president of Poland introduced a proposal, which Donald Trump, I think, heard fairly favorably, to try to pressure NATO countries to spend 3% of their gross domestic product instead of the 2% that half of them don't make anyway. That proposal makes sense coming from Poland, as I believe Poland, Greece, and America are the only three NATO countries who actually already spend more than 3% of their gross domestic product on defense. But again, that would be something that when you look at the NATO numbers, 2/3 of NATO's budget is paid for by the United States. If you spent 3% of gross domestic, now you're moving towards a place where like half of NATO's budget spent by the United States, the other half spent by Europe, which would take some pressure off these big $61 billion aid packages to Ukraine. It would also make the European Union a military power roughly on par with the United States. You're putting a lot of stock in the fact that Europe's going to remain an ally, which prophetically is not going to happen. So like I said, yeah, big decisions, but you could definitely see that regardless of what policymakers in Washington, D.C. wants, the math indicates that the Pax Americana is coming to an end. At some point, unless you make drastic spending cuts someplace, the national debt's going to be so big that America, whether it wants to or not, is going to have to be forced to prioritize defending the Mexican border and let Ukraine and Israel and Taiwan fend for themselves.
One thing I think that you see with a lot of this is that America's foolishness in dealing with foreign policy and warfighting decisions, you know, leads directly to the situation where America then can't afford to do all of these things. Like, there was a news story I saw this week where the U.S. Navy said they spent $1 billion just on ammunition over the last 6 months. So basically, the U.S. Navy shooting down Iranian missiles, Houthi missiles, they've spent $1 billion. You've got this ragtag bunch of desert tribesmen using speedboats and homemade rockets to take pot shots at ships. And America, the U.S. military has spent $1 billion just in weapons alone dealing with this. That's not including the fuel and all the other costs that come with having all of their ships, these massive ships in some cases, nuclear-powered aircraft carriers and things out over in the Middle East, which, if this is specific, like, you have a bit of strength and you could deal with them with a fraction of the cost. They're not that formidable, really, the Houthis, compared to the might of the U.S. military, if they're really willing to take care of the problem. You look at Ukraine. You know, we talked about Joe Biden kind of greenlighting Iran's attack on Israel. And in the months before Russia invaded Ukraine, right, he said, well, we're fine with Russia invading Ukraine as long as it's a small incursion. And obviously, this what we got was a lot bigger than a small incursion, but he was signaling America's not going to do anything. We've got a weak will. And the result of that, again, you know, how many billions would have been saved if America had responded strongly right up front instead of telegraphing weakness, inviting Russia in, and now we're kind of drib-drabbling billions here and there into the maw. And this is exactly what the Bible talks about. You know, one of the curses prophesied to come upon America is your strength shall be spent in vain. And this is one of the ways that it happens. Because we deal with these problems foolishly, we spend a lot of these money, and maybe they're good causes, maybe they're bad causes, depending on what that cause is. But even if it's in a good cause, it's spent in vain. I mean, that $1 billion spent shooting down Houthi missiles, that's a good cause, but it's not dealing with the problem. It's spent in vain, whereas we could have spent a much smaller amount up front and taken them out.
Yeah, that prophecy about the strength being spent in vain is really relevant. Another prophecy I wanted to highlight in this section is in Micah 5, verses 10 through 13, where God, speaking of end time Israel, says, "In that day I'll cut off your horses in the midst of you, and I will destroy your chariots. I'll cut the cities from off of the land and throw down your strongholds." And actually, if you read more of that chapter, the language is interesting there in Micah 5, as it really gives a strong indication that this isn't like a gradual decades-long atrophy-style decline, but it's more that, like, just kind of as America reaches the zenith of its power, it comes crashing down. So it's it becomes, like, after the Berlin Wall fell, like, during the 90s, America was the lone world superpower, and it's already fallen a good bit since then in relation to other nations, but the fall is very steep. It's a very steep fall. It's being cut off. It's being thrown down. You're losing your power. And one way you can get a military that strong to fall so fast is bankruptcy. And that really seems to be the two biggest problems in the American military these days are, one, all the woke nonsense that the generals are just destroying the leadership ability of it, which I've talked in other programs, but then also just America's financial situation is you don't have the economic might to sustain a world superpower for much longer, which leads to something like Micah 5, where, like, just as you kind of like hit your peak, it all comes falling down on you.
As you're saying this, you provided that Micah 5 quote, and I'm looking at this, and it's connecting horses, chariots, strongholds, cities, right? Major military assets to witchcrafts and soothsayers and graven images. So your behaviors, your worship, your morals, Micah 5 is connecting those two things, and that's not unique to Micah 5. Obviously, the Bible is trying to tell you that there's a connection between your behaviors, your beliefs, your morals, your actions, the actions of everyday people, and especially in the case of republics, connected to these, as we say, real-world effects. And that's part of the strategy, right? I mean, even Houthis and lesser organized, less powerful adversaries than them understand if you can do it, drain them slowly. I mean, they're willing to lose the occasional troops or terrorists for the sake of slowly bleeding the United States. Certainly, larger and more powerful adversaries understand that strategy, and they might get smashed, but it continues and the bleeding continues. And as you said, you know, when I look at that, I'm thinking politicians in Washington are arguing, oh, about money? Oh, okay. You know, it doesn't seem to be a big story, but you're framing that in terms of Pax Americana, this entire lifetime long era of relative peace in this squalid, bloody, dirty, unjust, you know, 6,000 year history of man. It's not peace, but it's been comparative peace for a lifetime now. That's all we've known. And that is coming to an end in, as you said, mathematical terms. And the warning is going out for those who are listening, and not even just from the Trumpet or Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury. We had General Michael Flynn here on campus on Sunday. He's been sounding the warning in a big way. And you know, something interesting I noticed from his movie was the first part was actually talking about the failures of our wars, even when we have gone into war and spent all the money in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in these other theaters. And he has said something that reminded me exactly what Herb W. Armstrong said, and that was that America won its last war back in World War II, which seemed hard to believe, but in his estimation, General Flynn's, we have become weaker and weaker and weaker with each successive war that we've supposedly won. And a lot of that has to do with the actual financial physical cost, as Winston Churchill often emphasized, the cost, physical financial cost of war. And you mentioned an article here in the outline you gave me, can America afford its military? Can America afford its military? And in real world terms, almost in real time, we're seeing the answer to that question play out. That is our hour of Trumpet Hour Week in Review. We thank you for being with us. We thank our panel, Richard Palmer, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, and Mihailo Zekic. And we thank Parker Campbell and Isaac Lorenz for engineering and production. Again, email us your thoughts on the program at letters@thetrumpet.com. We enjoy hearing from you, and we'd like you to contribute to the conversation, bring out things that we're not aware of and perspectives that might benefit us. And sometimes we might even talk about it on the air. But letters@thetrumpet.com is the email address if you want to get in touch with us. Thank you for listening this week to The Week in Review. We look forward to being back with you next time on Trumpet Hour.